Okay, we're live here. We're live, everybody.
We're in. We're doing it.
We're in.
We're in a little earlier than normal because I sometimes the lead up to when we click on the camera is some of the best stuff. So I just said, screw that. We're just going to click on the camera and go from
trying
there.
Trying to capture that lightning in the bottle.
Yeah. Trying, man. Is this only the second time you're on EC? Because I thought you were already on twice. Is this number two?
I'll have to go back and look. It might be three.
Okay, boss, have we had any repeats on?
You might be the only one. I think it's very possible.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway,
well, thank you.
You're an E-Lite company. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
I could have swore that we had Osorio on, but then when we interviewed him, he's like, I can't believe I'm finally on your show. I was like, wait a minute. Feels like we've been here before.
Yeah, we had you on like a year ago. He's like, nope, never. So
sorry, David.
This episode was sparked by, I reached out to EC to see if she'd be interested in doing it because I was listening to a podcast, a totally unrelated to strength and conditioning, unrelated to fitness, just a podcast I like to listen to from a very, you know, well-known individual. And the conversation drifted to fitness. Like the other guest in the show was like, I got to get in better shape or whatnot. And they just started chatting about it for a second. And basically, it was described as like, hey, if you're going to take your health and fitness seriously and you really want to do this, you got to work out for sure. Don't get me wrong. And you should eat well for sure. But if you're not supplementing your diet with vitamins, whatever, minerals, some sort of powders, mixtures, elixirs or whatnot, you are shooting yourself in the foot. You're not optimizing your benefits and you're operating at a fraction of capacity. And that was the overall general concept. And it's such a common one that I was like, let's just dive into this because I don't know. I think people would like to know, what do I really need to take? What moves the needle forward and what's just marketing? So that's the basis of it.
Yeah.
And so here you are. give people a little bit of background. Why in the heck would they want to listen to you?
Well, I started Optimize Me Nutrition. I worked for CrossFit for a number of years. I went through a lot of different fad and trendy diets at the time. I went down a lot of different rabbit holes. I did a lot of different supplements and different testing protocols myself, all in the name of optimal health. And then I eventually went on and got a master's in nutrition and became a licensed dietitian nutritionist and went through all the science and realized a lot of it I didn't need. And was actually just a waste of time. And if anything, really harmful from a neurotic perspective, was kind of taking away from my own quality of life. Just really like helping people understand what's real and what they need to do. And what's just as, actually was an article that I really like talking about supplements, but and what's just a harmful distraction.
I have a question for you. And that is, first of all, what I like about your approach and what I like having you on the program is I feel like you are to nutrition what I hope that like Boz and I are to strength and conditioning, which is eliminate the nonsense, do what works, and you know, get the smoke and mirrors out of the way. Did you seeking that credential, going out and getting your master's, which I know was not an easy thing to do, was that something you just needed to do in the way that the world works to establish credibility and so people would listen to you, or was it actually a meaningful procedure to increase your knowledge? Because what it reminds me of is, what was that book? It's like Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution something. Do you remember that? It's this guy who was an engineer and just reverse engineered what was potentially causing, you know, insulin spikes and diabetes and insulin resistance, and told all the doctors, they're like, we're not going to listen to you. You're not a physician. And he's like, no, but look at the data. Like, okay, sir, we'll take it from here. The elites will take it from here. And then the guy, like way later in life, went to medical school and then presented his exact same thesis with no changes. But now he was a doctor and everyone's like, this is revolutionary. This is genius. Thank you, doctor. And so like, where did it fall into when you went and got that credential?
Yeah. Honestly, at CrossFit, we had continuing education requirements for some of the staff. And I was kind of interested in nutrition. Obviously, I'd done a lot of stuff on my own and part of some of the nutrition content there. And so that's why I started the degree. It was kind of, I needed to do something and it fell within something that made sense for me to do. But upon completion, I will say it does help to have the credentials. I think I'm not naive enough to think that people have to have credentials to know what they're talking about. But I do think that when there is so much information out there and when there is so much different conflicting information out there, that it is one way to help people kind of sort out who to listen to. And I don't want to say that people who have the credentials all say the correct thing or the best stuff.
Sure.
But it's one thing to kind of put them in the ballpark of, okay, well, let me look at these people and then start discerning among them versus just, let's say, an MD who's never done any nutrition. You know, maybe I'll go ahead and follow the nutritionist people.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And were you largely in agreement with the academic text that you had to go through to get their credential, or did you have to endorse some of it and politely disagree and then get the credential?
Certainly the latter. Yeah. You know,
interesting. Okay.
When I started it, I definitely had more of a strong belief still in the natural realm, and natural is always better, which was sort of a strong belief for me for a period of time. And kind of the more and more as I progressed and also got experience and did more research on my own, not necessarily for the degree, the more it was like, yeah, a lot of this stuff is just noise.
You know, this is something that is a bit of a half-baked thought, but they're the best ones, right? But it just hit me. And I guess, you know, the more experience I have with these different realms of health and fitness and just the world at large, it seems to me like any degree program, if it's framed correctly, I think you can get what you need out of it. And to me, I think a lot of the framing is like, here is an established body of knowledge to date. Mm-hmm. And then from that, you can start to move forward and draw some conclusions and apply critical thinking to what might be a logical next step within that body of knowledge. But to me, I think, and nutrition, for whatever reason, seems to be particularly bad in this regard. People take that established body of knowledge and say, I'm going to use this as a predictive mechanism for all future scenarios that could ever happen. And all you're going to need to know is what we've presented to you here, and it's case closed, so to speak.
Yeah.
And to me, that's where I think like any degree program is, you know, you got to frame it correctly. It's not the be all and end all because it cannot be. The totality of human knowledge is not like final.
2 years.
But it can create a decent jumping off point. And I think people confuse the two all the time, right? On both ends of the spectrum, both the student will confuse it as like, well, this is all I'm ever going to need to know. And the lay person looking at that expert saying like, well, they know everything that needs to be known. And therefore I can just trust whatever comes out of their mouth verbatim.
Totally.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that point a lot. That wasn't half baked. That was good. That was full baked.
Maybe three quarter.
I do think if anything, it also allows you the time to really dig into the research. So maybe what you're being presented is not necessarily the take that you would conclude, but at least you now have a jumping off point and also some places to start. And again, the time to really be like, no, I need to look at this issue about, you know, protein consumption or whatever it is and really dig in. So I think that's also the benefit of a degree that, yes, you can learn a lot on your own, but sometimes we all need a little bit of structure and guidance to get a little bit more done.
Yeah,
you know, one of the other things I like having you in the program, like your content as well, is it seems like you're one of the few people that actually reads the studies or reads the research papers and not just the summary, and then can actually discern whether or not from the actual research, was the short summary that was presented an accurate representation, or was it a bit of a stretch or somewhat misleading, or did they leave something critical out? And that, I'm guilty of it as well. I don't have the time. I don't read the studies. I look at the summary and move on with my life. And then all of a sudden I realize that I shouldn't be doing something, or it was not as beneficial as I thought. So again, that's all the backstory as to why I think we're going to hopefully have a good conversation today about some stuff that's, you
some
can't help but hear. Yeah. So, I mean, should we just dive right in?
Yeah. What do you want to talk about?
Well, we've got a few that we want to hit, and there's a couple that popped into my head as well that, you know, if you're prepared for, great. If not, we can shelve for a later time. But one of the ones on your list, which is, you know, I live in the Pacific Northwest, sadly, you know, up here in the Washington state, and it's cloudy more often than it's sunny. And so I hear constantly, hey, you're living up there. If you're not supplementing with vitamin D and a rather good dose of it, you are going to be in a deficiency and you're going to get sick more often, and all these bad things are going to happen. So it's presented as a, not an option, but you've got to be doing this. And so, fact or fiction?
I'm going to start calling you Brittle Bone Sherwood.
Right.
Until, I mean, until you start supplementing with vitamin D.
I'd be pulling 550 on a deadlift if it has more vitamin
That's
D.
Right. That's right. That's the only problem. Yeah, I mean, certainly I'm not against supplementation, but vitamin D, I can go in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways that I would like to go is I think we're in this age of personalization and always doing a targeted nutrition approach. And we've got all this cutting edge science, and that's why we can make stuff so personalized. But then people will listen to an influencer who just says, everybody needs to take 5,000 IUs per day.
Right.
And
sure.
It's like, yeah. What? Wait, hold on. Where was the personalization? Where was the uniqueness? Where was the looking at your context? All of that stuff. So I find that so ironic that in this age that everybody has all this quote data and biohacking that will just take these blanket supplement recommendations without thinking about the context. Are there people living in very northern, northeast or northwest climates or, you know, places that aren't getting a lot of sun? Sure. Maybe they need to supplement. Sure. But let's go ahead and get measured at the doctor's office and see what our levels are, and then supplement to an appropriate level to get them to where they need to be versus just sort of taking a blanket amount. And I threw out that 5,000 IU because I've heard that by other influencers. Let me tell you that the RDA is 600 IUs per day.
Oh,
and also what is recommended is that the tolerable upper limit is only about 2,000 IUs per day.
So where in the world do you think something, you know, 2.5 times as high as the potential upper limit even comes from?
Great question. Great question.
With an unknown origin.
Yeah. And that's the thing is when we look at vitamin D supplementation research, it doesn't show that much benefit. So remember in the research, we have different types of studies. And the two that I like to touch on right now are going to be like the association studies. And then we have the randomized controlled trials. And what we find with the association studies, which is the whole correlation does not equal causation thing, but what we find in those studies is that people who have low vitamin D often tend to be more sick or tend to have more instances of a disease. And so the easy conclusion from those type of studies would be, oh, well, if I just increase my vitamin D, this will prevent depression or this will prevent cancer or whatever. But when we go to the randomized control trials, we don't find that to be the case. And so one of the things that we have to remember about association studies is the potential for reverse causation. Maybe the people have low vitamin D because they have the disease. Vitamin D is used in the immune system. So maybe because the immune system is trying to fight whatever they have, that's why their vitamin D is going down. Not by taking more vitamin D are they going to prevent it. So it's almost looking at it from the reverse angle. And so this is why that potentially when we go to randomized control trials and we give people vitamin D, we don't necessarily see these clinical outcomes. Like all of a sudden now everything is prevented.
Interesting. Well, I don't want to go ahead, Buzz.
Well, I was just going to say, I'd love to take a step back even further. Because one of the things that I see all the time, and EC, I would be sure that you'd agree on this, and please let me know if you don't. But I feel like the bigger issue 9 times out of 10 is that most people just don't have basic nutritional literacy at all. Mm. And so they are interested in this conversation around, well, is it 5,000 IUs or is it 500? And yet you go and look at what they had for breakfast and you're like, oh my God, this is not the conversation we need to be having. So taking it one step back, let's talk just about RDA. So that's, you know, recommended daily allowance, right? Mm-hmm. Where did those numbers come from? Can you talk a little bit about that? How much faith do you have in them? How are they established? You know, like that might be a great starting point for people that are not as deep into this world as, you know, someone like yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. The RDA, what they do is they make estimates about the average requirement that somebody would need for each of those nutrients. But then we're dealing with biology. I always like comparing it to height because I think it's so easy to understand. Like the average height might be 5'8". But then if we look at the variation around 5'8", there's a lot of people that fall between 5 feet and 6'2" or something like that. Like that's probably 90-some% of the population, right? So the average might be 5'8", but we've got this huge biological variability, that natural bell curve. Mm-hmm. So they do that with the RDA as well. They look at what the average requirement might be. And then for my statisticians out there, they go up 2 standard deviations and set the RDA. So now the RDA is sufficient for 97.5% of the population. That's at the upper end of the bell curve. Hmm. You could say it's like saying it's good for the people that are 6'2", right? In this case, or enough for up to 6'2". And so it's a very, I use the word conservative, and in this case, I mean health protective, that when somebody hits 100% of the RDA, in many cases, it's actually more than they need. And so when you look at the back of, let's say, multivitamins and other supplements, and they'll show you like 500%, it's like, why do I need 500% of B12?
Right.
Like 100% is actually probably more than a lot of people need already. So this idea now that I need above and beyond that is just excessive. And this is why a lot of us just have expensive urine when we do supplementation.
I love that. That's my favorite, just kind of push back on people that are spending so much money on pills and powders and stuff is the old expensive urine. But I want to push even further on that. So the establishment of that RDA, like, what does that process look like? And again, like, how much faith do you have in that? And with how much certainty do you think that, you know, like, are those numbers subject to change as our knowledge improves on the human biology? Is that something that's relatively understood and is likely to remain static? You know, that sort of thing I think is interesting as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're set by the Institute of Medicine, which I think is under another name now. And yes, you know, it's the establishment government related. I have a good amount of confidence in them. Now, am I able to say that they're never going to change? No. In fact, I think they've changed the RDA slightly, but sometimes they're changing the RDA based on what people are eating. And so then they go ahead and start fortifying foods to try to get us to shore up to our numbers, as well as, okay, maybe the standards have changed, or maybe some, you know, new assessment technique have come out. Cause this is very hard to do. I mean, obviously we have a huge range in terms of body size and needs to try to establish what the needs are for each nutrient. But the fact that they already take into account the bioavailability of these nutrients when they set the RDA, so how much would actually be absorbed, as well as looking at this natural bell curve and not just taking the average, but going up on it, I'm quite confident that these numbers are protective enough because, you know, I also like to remind people that like supplementation didn't become a thing till the 1930s and not didn't really explode till the 70s, or you can even argue the 90s with the Supplement Act of 1994, which we might touch on. But it's like, okay, so somehow we got to 1930s as a species without all this supplementation. Now, that doesn't mean that what we were doing historically was optimum, but it does mean that we were probably pretty robust in the face of some pretty basic nutrient, you know, foods around us and lifestyles, right? And so I like to remind people of that too, that like, I think we're more advanced in terms of our understanding of what we need, and that we definitely are erring on the side of conservation or a conservative approach to be most health protective.
That's
more
really
so than ever before.
Yeah, it's really interesting if you look at it in that context as well. Like, not only were supplements non-existent, but I bet you, and you know, I'm no agricultural historian, but prior to that, I mean, you look at the variability in the average person's diet from 1930 prior. I bet you it's the same four or five staples season after season, year in, year out. Like, how modern an invention of the supermarket where you can go and get something that's totally out of season, but jet it in from across the world and you can just have it at your fingertips whenever you desire. You know, that kind of availability and therefore diversity in your nutrient profile didn't exist either. So it's like a double whammy. And yet somehow we still made it, right? The species we got here.
Exactly. And there's that's how they actually developed or figured out vitamin deficiencies, because there were people who had entire diets that were corn, right? Or, you know, entire diets of the potato family. It's like, okay, it turns out while the potato has a good number of different nutrients in it, more so than most people think, it doesn't actually cover all of our bases. And so it's like, okay, we might need to supplement with this thing. Or that's how they figured out, you know, vitamin C and scurvy and stuff like that, because the diets were so monotone or so single food, right? And so again, I think it does show how robust we are. And with just some diversity in the diet, let alone the fortification that we now add to our food so that we don't have this problem, the idea that we're all just walking around so deficient is a little bit overstated or too much, you know, fear-mongering there.
You mentioned that you do have relatively decent faith in the RDA. And then you mentioned how some of if you look at the back of a bottle of vitamins, it gives you way over above what that happens to be. And a lot of people are taking those every single solitary day. So that begs the question, is going wildly over the RDA, is it just simply unnecessary, or is it and you're just wasting your money, or is it actually potentially harmful?
Yeah, both. Now, thankfully, the body is remarkably resilient. There's a couple things here. One, the body is remarkably resilient. And so some of these tolerable upper limits, they're kind of just good guesses, or we don't really know. It's like, okay, well, so far, so good. You know, we don't really know at which point there's going to be toxicity. And also, people aren't always super consistent with taking supplements. So there is a little bit of grace in the fact that, you know, somebody might take a high dose for a short period of time, but then they stop taking the supplement. And so therefore, it becomes less risky. So there is a little bit of that as well. But I think some of the other things to keep in mind about supplements that are important is not just the risk of potentially the oversupplementation, which might be not necessary and or lead to toxicity at some point, but the fact that there's also contamination and the fact that there's also lack of purity. And so
what do you mean?
The thing might say, okay, in this multivitamin, there is 100 milligrams of magnesium. But when we look at the research for people who do third-party testing, is one, the supplement might not have magnesium at all. And if it does,
that's kind of a bummer if that's what you're buying.
I know. It's insane that sometimes things that are listed on the bottle are not actually in the product. And sometimes the concentration that's listed is nowhere near it. It could have this is one supplement study that looked at selenium, 200 times the amount of listed. And these people actually did have to get hospitalized because of the lack of regulation around supplements. Now, there are these third-party companies, NSF, USP, and what they do is they're these third-party companies that are not government-sanctioned, but they're just third-party independent companies that verify what you have in the supplement is what you say. So that's a good thing, right? Like if you're going to say, I have 100 milligrams of magnesium, I want 100 milligrams of magnesium and I don't want THC in that thing. And you might laugh, but like CBD supplements are often contaminated with THC, which might be a nice surprise for some people, but there's all types of contamination. Actually, just looking at another study, I was looking at some performance enhancing supplements and they found like FDA prohibited ingredients in there. And so, you know, I know know of people who get popped all the time for stuff and they say, I don't know. Well, contamination happens. So we have these third party companies to verify, okay, cool. What you say is in the bottle at the right concentration or amount. That's a good first step. What those companies are not saying, which is also confusing the supplement. And now I'm getting on a little bit rant, but they're not verifying the claims are correct. So people will often be like, oh, cool, this is NSF certified, which yes, in terms of purity and accuracy, it now means is correct. But NSF is not saying, oh, this builds strong bones or whatever the claim is, which is another topic.
That contamination thing, is it, I'm sure it's not 100% of everything you buy, but is it high enough above zero to be actually like, oh, this is, you know, significant enough to be like, huh, this happens with more regularity than most folks would realize.
Well, here we go. This is the study that was looking at 57 different performance enhancing sports supplements. 40% of them did not contain a detectable amount of the labeled ingredients.
40%?
So just flushing money down the toilet, quite literally.
Wow.
Yep.
That's 12, amazing.
12%. So not bad, over 10%. 12% were found to contain at least one FDA prohibited ingredient.
1 out of 10 chance. Good, great.
And then this was interesting too. Of the products that contain detectable amounts of the listed ingredients, so this is the in case of like, okay, this thing, it has magnesium. They found magnesium in it. The actual quantity ranged from 0.02% to 334% of what the label says would be in there.
Big range.
It's like the Wild West out there, really.
It is. And so there was like, it's called like the Dietary Something Supplement Act of 1994. It allowed supplements to be regulated as food, which people in hindsight say was a gift to the supplement industry. Because think about it. If you're like, let's take whey protein, like that's in milk. Milk is regulated a certain way. It comes from the cow. You can sell it, all that stuff. But if you're then like, okay, well, this is just whey protein. I just kind of separated it out from the milk. Does it need a different set of regulations? And so the answer was no. Like if the vitamin E is in the almonds, do I need a different set of regulations for vitamin E capsules? What they decided on was no. But what that ultimately means is the product does not have to be, you know, blessed before it goes to market. drugs have to go through this whole process to say, okay, what are they doing? And are the claims correct? And when it says this much of the drug, it actually has that much of the drug. It has to be pre-approved. Where supplements get to go to the market first. And then if they're caught, there's issues, but there's no kind of pre-approval. And so what we found, or what we find, is that I think it was around 1994, there was about 4,000 different supplements on the market. And by 2020, there's over 80,000 different products. And it's like had a 10x growth in terms of just money in the whole industry. It's insane because there's just such this lack of regulation.
And it is, you know, well, then now's a good time to tell you that Boz and I are launching a line of supplements and products.
It's been a long time coming.
Just trust us, okay? They work great. Yeah.
All of the episodes we've done up to this point were just to get building credibility. Community buy-in.
Yep. Look, I got three kids that got to go to college.
I know, it's a good way to make money.
But you know what's funny is like, you know, I don't know what I'll do in the future, but like if I did or if somebody else did or whatnot, I would want it to be legit, right? Like, mm-hmm. you mentioned there's that third party that says this is or isn't in it, but it didn't do something else, didn't verify the claims, right? Are there actual some out there that do both? Like, maybe it's a very small percentage where you look at this and it says, yes, it says it has these ingredients in it, and we verify that it does. And then we said that it helps whatever it is, and there's a way to verify that, or you can't have both.
There is no organization that does that. I mean, PubMed does that by way of research, and by way of, you know, what's been shown. Now, there are some supplements that will run their own clinical trials, but then we run into the issue of bias, you know, and they might put on the side of their bottle, this is the proprietary blend, and that they ran some clinical research with it. You know, I'm not saying that everybody who runs their own research has bias, but you do definitely want that to be confirmed by an independent lab of people that are not working for the company.
Okay. I've got one more question on this topic that I think we're still related to.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Adrian has something. So we chatted about the RDA, what that actually means, where it came from, if you think it's, you know, doing good. Some supplement stuff, some verifying claims. What happens if you go over? You mentioned for a second with like the vitamin D, which was the original question, and deficiency and what that could potentially lead to and all that stuff. You know, there was that, and how you said your body might be fighting something. Maybe that's why you're deficient, right? Because I don't want to get our podcast on YouTube blocked for saying the wrong word, but we all remember there was like a global thing that happened a while ago. And you know, you heard that, you know, a large number of those people were vitamin D deficient, like quite a high percentage is what you heard. I guess, because when you hear that, it makes you think, well, the deficiency played a significant cause in this, and deficiency must be a catastrophic thing if I'm deficient in something. What does being, quote unquote, deficient in a vitamin actually mean, or a mineral?
Yeah. So again, in that scenario where we had a very large event for a couple years, the point that I was trying to make earlier was the association that, you know, like over 80% of the people were deficient in vitamin D were hospitalized was something that was mentioned on that podcast. Remember that the sickness might be driving the deficiency once they're in the hospital and getting measured. And that necessarily having high vitamin D might not have prevented them from getting hospitalized. It's now that they have the sickness and their body's trying to fight it off that maybe that's driving the vitamin D to go lower.
Right. Okay. Because that would be where somebody would think, as well, if I wasn't vitamin D deficient to begin with, I wouldn't have wound up in the hospital. But that's, you can't make that leap, is what you believe.
Exactly. That's why we have to do the randomized control trials. We have to see what the right order of operations was. You're assuming that the low vitamin D drove the hospitalization. Maybe the hospitalization drove the low vitamin D.
Gotcha. Okay.
But what I do like the point about understanding deficiency, because that word you'll just hear in headlines, you know, X number of people are deficient in vitamin D. It could be about magnesium.
But it's like my hormones are out of whack.
Another very general one.
Got to get them in whack.
I did. But it's really important to know that, like, when you say deficient, I think it comes with this assumption that we're all talking about the same level. And vitamin D in particular is a rather controversial one in terms of deficiency. So I did go back and look at the study that was looking at the hospitalization rate. And the way that they define deficiency is the one that I agree with. And that's the same one as the Institute of medicine, and that is to be less than 20 nanograms per milliliter. But in that same podcast clip, they happen to talk about studies related to getting colds in the winter because of low vitamin D. I pulled up that study, and when they were talking about deficiency, they talked about less than 10 nanograms per liter. And I know when I go get it measured, my vitamin D at my general practitioner, they consider deficiency less than 30 nanograms per liter. And it actually varies quite dramatically between countries of where the deficiency for cutoff is for vitamin D. And again, vitamin D tends to be a little bit more controversial than some other nutrients, it seems. But this is really important because there are going to be a lot more people who are, quote, considered deficient if you set your level at 30.
Right.
Versus a country that might set it at 10, or the researchers that set it at 10, or the researchers that set it at 20. And so, listening to that podcast, I'm under the belief that the individual thinks that deficiency is going to be a much higher value, partially because they supplement so much and they recommend a high level of supplementation. And it's just like, okay, well, now we have to be clear about where the levels are of when they're looking at the study, that you might be thinking deficiency is less than 30, but they might be looking at it levels of 20 or even 10, depending on what study it might be. It could even be other ones too, but that's just really important. I think it's a lot of stuff in nutrition. It happens with carbs and fat. People will be like, oh, I'm eating high carb or high fat or something like that. Like, what does that mean in terms of the absolute value? Because we could be talking now about like apples and oranges here.
Do you have to request to get your vitamin D measured? Or if you go for your annual checkup with the doctor, you know, is that something which just happens? Or do I need to request this and it's a special side gig?
I think most doctors will do it as an annual physical, but if they don't, I don't think they would have a problem doing it. It's pretty standard to do it at least once a year. Yeah, mine did it as part of kind of my general annual physical.
I have no idea what my levels are. I'm sure they're fantastic.
Obviously. I would believe it, Pat. Healthy as a horse.
Exactly. Eating clean, whatever that means.
That's right.
The thing is about vitamin D is there aren't really a ton of food sources for it. So out of the nutrients, it tends to be the one that people are like, okay, I understand get stuff from food, but then vitamin D doesn't really exist in a lot of foods. So how do we do that one? Now, obviously sun exposure is how we get a lot of our vitamin D, and probably 20, 30 minutes a few times a week is enough. But there are cases where people might not be getting enough sun exposure, and then darker color skin makes that harder. But I also like to remind people that a lot of food is fortified. I was actually just looking at, I drink that Fairlife milk. I mean, that's got vitamin D in it, right? A yogurt brand that I use has vitamin D in it. And partially they've done this because they know that people aren't getting enough sun exposure and stuff like that. So this is another reason why people who are just like, well, I'm listening to this influencer who says 5,000 IUs a day. It's like, well, maybe you're really active, A, and outside, and B, maybe you're taking enough biofortification anyway.
Is that, so that's not nonsense. Like if a food says fortified with whatever, that actually helps drive the needle.
Yeah, fortified definitely is a regulated word to mean that, yeah, nutrients have been added back to the product.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. That's not just slick marketing, Pat.
Okay. Fortified. All right. This podcast is fortified with knowledge. It means you can take it to the bank.
There you go.
Definitely. 100%.
That third party regulatory verification that we entered into. Yeah. Well, I like to kind of talk broadly. You know, we've gone down this exploratory route around vitamin D, and that's really cool. If we back out of that a little bit, and you mentioned earlier that it seems to be really in vogue these days to have more of a personalized approach and, you know, to start to optimize for somebody's unique needs, etc. And while I don't disagree that that can be really useful, I personally feel that most people need a broader approach and would benefit from, you know, at least some broad information that they can kind of get a foothold on. And so kind of viewing it through that lens, do you have, and maybe you don't for the reasons I just specified, but do you have a list of kind of supplements that in general you would say they actually do matter and they are worthwhile? And, or maybe the converse where you're like, hey, here are some popular ones that are just absolutely not worth your time. You know, I was lucky enough to, talked to one of the nutritionists they had at the Power Monkey camp recently, and he was talking about how BCAAs are just every athlete's favorite supplement to take because they taste good, and you know they're supposed to help with all this great recovery, et cetera, et cetera. And he's like, they are the biggest waste of time. It's like it doesn't make any sense if you're trying to build a house to just get more nails and screws. And that's the only building blocks that you have access to. It's like it does not build your house. It just means you have more nails and screws. Anyway, so rant over on that. That's one that he was very staunch, like, this is a waste of everybody's time and people are getting rich off of your ignorance, you know. Mm-hmm. So do you have some that you'd broadly recommend or that you would broadly condemn?
Yeah. I really like that analogy for BCAs. That's perfect. So I might be stealing that one. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't recommend any supplements. I have two that are in the worth a shot bucket for performance, and I'll touch on those in a second.
Worth a shot. That's good.
that's trademarked, right?
No, yeah, I like it.
Worth a shot. But I want to touch on the don't recommend. Mm. There is not even enough evidence to recommend a multivitamin.
Hmm.
Like the most basic of supplements is a multivitamin, and we don't even have enough evidence to recommend multivitamins. The idea, I think, for a lot of people taking supplements is this idea of preventative health, of, you know, living to 150 years old and, you know, being active and preventing all the diseases and stuff like that. Well, our two top killers are cardiovascular disease and cancer. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is an independent and volunteer, that's key, volunteer organization made up of mostly MDs, some nurses, came out with a statement about we don't even have the evidence that they do anything for cardiovascular disease and cancer. And in some cases, we actually find that some high dose vitamins might increase risk of cancer. But that's another discussion. So it's like, what am I going to recommend if we can't even recommend multivitamins, which typically contain the essential nutrients we need, right? So it's just like how these other things that are just come up in the last year or so, like we have all this science and evidence that they're doing all this stuff when we can't even show that multivitamins are helping us. Mm. And then people are so worried about other, you know, well, what else besides cardiovascular disease and cancer? It's like, guys, if you're taking this for prevention and it doesn't do anything for our two top killers, I don't know that there's much evidence for it. So yeah, I really don't recommend supplements. Certainly there's going to be cases of deficiency. There's going to be cases of people whose diets, just by way of what they choose, you know, might be anemic, deficient in iron, sometimes in pregnancy, just to, again, be super sure that we have enough stuff. We might supplement with folic acid or something like that. But yeah, there's just not a lot of evidence for me to really recommend anything from a general health perspective.
But I thought if I didn't have a shake within 20 minutes of my workout, then the workout didn't.
I don't mind protein shakes because I just see them as almost a protein food. But I mean any type of kind of like a...
It's a delivery system, right?
I thought you were putting that under supplements. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. I hear you. That one's walking the line for me.
Is that in the worth a shot?
That one I really do consider... I like what Adrian said, kind of a delivering mechanism. I just see that as a food. It's a way to get a macronutrient.
Okay, so that one gets the highly coveted EC thumbs up.
if it allows you to hit your protein target, but you don't need them.
Okay.
And you don't need to have them at specific times.
I have mine after my workout each day just because it tastes like a cookies and cream milkshake. And it's absolutely delicious.
And that's okay. I'm okay with things that are enjoyable in the diet.
And if I found out it did nothing, I'd still drink it because it tastes really good.
There you go. And it does give you protein.
Yes, for sure.
Okay, so what's in the worth a shot bucket? These are for performance goals. And they would be caffeine and creatine.
I had creatine written down CNC. To talk with you about. Okay. That's cool.
These things have been... This is another thing that drives me a little bit batty. What gets attention in the literature or science is like the cutting edge research and the cutting edge science. And this study just came out. No. You want the stuff that's been studied backwards and forwards, beaten to death by hundreds of different people independently. That you want like the stuff that's
old,
been
reliable.
Reliable.
Yeah.
And caffeine and creatine are there. Now, again, we're talking about biology and we're talking about a lot of different performance endeavors and lots of different ways that people express themselves in their performance endeavors, such that these are not going to necessarily, I took caffeine and now I just all of a sudden won, you know, the Ironman triathlon. But what we find consistently across the literature is that more studies show performance benefit than not. I think for caffeine, we're on the order of maybe a 5-10% performance bump, and creatine can be 10-15% in terms of strength and power. And for me, once we're over that 5% performance change, to me, we're outside of a typical placebo effect. And so it is enough to sit up and take notice, especially when there's hundreds of studies done on these supplements, not just one or two.
Yeah. I think that's, Pat, I was just going to say, sitting on creatine for a little bit, I think that's interesting in a couple of ways. You know, number one, I really like what you said there about like, no, don't take the new hot girl out just because she's in vogue. You know what I mean? It's like, no. You want somebody that you built a relationship with, that you have this inherent trust, you know, you've been around a long time. Like that seems to be such a no-brainer that people miss all the time. It's like, no, take something that has had a lot of looks at it. I think that's really worth pausing on for a second. And creatine in particular, I think it's really interesting, and I don't follow it too closely, but I have heard rumblings that there have been a lot more kind of benefits that people have placed into creatine, or at least like, you know, what they previously understood about it, up to and including like cognitive benefits and protective mechanisms. And I think that's really interesting too. And I think bolsters that idea that, hey, if you have something that's shown to have a proven track record and continues in ways that were previously maybe unexamined, maybe that's worth pursuing. Maybe that is why it's in that worthwhile bucket.
Worth a shot.
I've got two questions on creatine.
Yeah.
Number one, you said, I believe it was at anywhere from a 5 to 15% or 10 to
15%. Yeah, 10 to 15%, yeah.
Benefit, but A, what is the supposed benefit? And is it just for strength and power athletes, or would it work well for a mixed modality GPP CrossFit sort of person as well? So what is the benefit? And is it just for one of those segments of athletes?
So the thing is with all these studies is obviously they have a huge variation in how they're run. Like it's a group of researchers being like, I want to see if creatine helps soccer players. And so we're going to test that with down and back sprints. And the next people are like, I want to see if this helps strength. And so we're going to do 3x10 bicep curls and a 1 rep max leg press. So you have this is one of the things with research. It's like you have this, you know, you look at all these studies and there's so many different ways that they're tested that you have to kind of start to draw some lines and commonalities among them and also know that it's probably not going to be totally perfect to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But so when I say the 10 to 15%, that's kind of in strength and power type exercises. And so you could take a weight and let's say that creatine might give you a 10% bump on what you're lifting. So it's just sort of the outcome that they were measuring in terms of strength and power could have increased by 10 to 15%. But of course, that could be a 1 rep max. That could be a wattage on a bike, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely appropriate for a CrossFitter because creatine is part of the phosphocreatine pathway, right? That helps us generate energy in that really short duration. And so anything that's got repeated reps at a high intensity, that's not at just body weight, could be worth a shot to try creatine. We do get creatine from our diet, but also the intensity at which you execute your workout, which is what I was saying, people express their performance differently, will all come into play to determine how much of that supplement might give a benefit for you, which is why you can't just take creatine and be like, I am now going to PR today. It's still going to come down to like, what's the weight relative to your capacity? How hard do you go? Maybe even diet. If you were really low on creatine or if you're really high on creatine, you might actually not notice, you know? So there's all these other things that make it not necessarily a guarantee, but certainly the majority of evidence suggests that there is a benefit from it performance-wise.
Okay. Very cool. That's interesting. I have a couple more specific product questions. So, Boz, if you've got any general stuff you want to broader.
I mean, I am all general, Pat. So maybe while we're on the topic of creatine, we could go through your specifics and then we pull back out a little bit.
These are the ones that I hear about a lot. And I'm always quick to say, like, to be honest with you, I'm not quite sure. It's not my field of expertise. Essential fatty acids, fish oil. Got to take it every day. You know, that's probably one of the more common. And I did for a long period of time just because everyone told me that I should. And I didn't read it. I didn't read any of the studies, to be quite honest with you. I was just going along with the herd. And the herd looked pretty healthy around me. So
I understand.
So I was doing it. So what's your thoughts on that?
I don't recommend fish oil. I also took it for a period of time. But again, when we look at something to take it for prevention, it's like I need to see that this is doing something for prevention. And to me, if you're not touching our two top killers, I don't know what you're preventing. You know, for fish oil, and I'm just looking at kind of the research here, they have a Cochrane review on them. And Cochrane reviews are known for how stringent they are in terms of accepting high quality studies to then make an assessment over whether or not the supplement does the thing that it's supposed to or whatever the topic they're looking at. But they're known hey, we're going to look at a bunch of research, but we're going to be really strict on what we include because a lot of studies don't have the best quality. Maybe they didn't blind the researcher, all of this stuff. And so they basically found that with high certainty of evidence, long chain omega-3 fats do not have positive or negative effects on mortality, i.e. dying, or cardiovascular events.
Okay.
Then I found another review on, and it wasn't a Cochrane review, so less stringent, but here they're pulling together 47 randomized controlled trials looking at supplementation with omega-3 fats, little or no effect on cancer diagnosis, cancer death, or breast cancer diagnosis. So they also look at all the different cancers individually, but no effect on cancer death or diagnosis. So again, you know, when we start to look at these controlled trials, which are the highest quality trials, when we look at them in terms of, okay, what is killing us tends to be cardiovascular disease and cancer, and they fall apart. It's like, well, we're definitely not going to have a ton of evidence for a really specific other little small nuance thing, you know?
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah, okay. Well, especially because in my mind, I think that's, fish oil seems so linked to cardiovascular health in the way that it's marketed and promoted, right? It's like mm-hmm. that is, because when you said that, okay, what are we preventing? Cardiovascular disease or a cancer being the two primary buckets, like immediately in my mind, fish oil is linked to cardiovascular outcomes, right? So interesting that when you look under the hood, that doesn't seem to be the case in the long run.
Well, Boz, let me remind you, the supplement industry is now a $50 billion industry in the U.S. Yep. with $900 million of marketing.
Yeah, so, no surprise. Yep.
And now, again, with
a lot of nice
studies,
beach houses there on the CEOs, you know what I mean?
Remember, like, there are going to be some studies that show something positive happens.
Sure.
But we can never take that one study. So somebody will say, I have evidence that fish oil is positive. And it's like, okay, well, you might have gotten one or two studies, but what happens when we look across 47?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not to say that. It's not to say that it's a total wash all the time. Like, there may be certain instances where it is actually very protective and preventative for that particular person in the context of what they may need. That does not mean you can extrapolate it and apply it across the population, right? And I think that's where the kind of smoke and mirrors is all the time.
And I do, I really like that point too, because I think a lot of times people will just take stuff to be like, it's just preventative. And it's like, well, for what? And what are we trying to fix? And do we have anything to fix? And maybe we do. And maybe there's a really great application for this. And there are some, you know, GI disorders, for example, that I think some supplements can be really useful for. But it's like, okay, do you have the diagnosis that you have this thing? Or are you just sort of like, I'm going to take a probiotic, right? And it's like, well, what is it doing? Yeah. And how are we measuring what's changing? And so fish oil, I know, for example, has been looked at also for depression. And from what I've seen, it also does not change that. But that's how you want to approach this. You don't want to just be like, it's going to prevent. And it's like, okay, well, what are we trying to do? And do we have specific studies on that? And then does it work or not, right?
Tell you what it's going to prevent, Pat. It's going to prevent your wallet from getting too heavy.
I was going to say, just like some people think that you can out-train a bad diet, I'm sure there's some people that think you can just add supplements to a not great diet and then it'll average out. It's like, I don't eat that great, but look at my cabinets. Look at all the stuff I'm taking every day. I'm getting what I need. And it's like, well, you're probably not doing what you should be doing. So I've got one more specific one, unless you had something on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in there. I think I like to I want to pause on that, if you will, or as Boz said, but it's like, I feel like I see that a lot, even with protein. And you mentioned kind of the protein shakes. And I'm not against protein powders, but I find a lot
like
of...
you are.
I find that a lot of my clients, because of the influencing in the space or whoever's saying what, are all targeting 1 gram per pound of body weight. And I don't think that's harmful. You're not necessarily going to have problems there, but you are just getting more calories at that point. It might not be necessary. And so I have a lot of clients who I think are just supplementing. It's like under this guise of I will gain muscle and I will, you know, more protein, more muscle, more lean mass. And the other thing that we always have to remember is, with resistance training.
Yeah.
Like we can't just take the protein powder and be like, wow, my biceps. It needs to be in combination with the resistance training. And I'm not always sure the volume is there to necessitate these really high protein intakes. In fact, I know it's not there. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's one of those things too that I think dovetails into so many of the themes that Pat and I explore regularly, where, you know, somebody believes that maybe they're endeavoring a little bit more intensely than they actually are. Mm. It's like, hey, man, you know, the 3 or 4 times a week that you get a good workout in, that doesn't mean that you need to be taking all of these, all of these restorative measures. It's like you're not as intense as maybe you think you are. It doesn't mean that what you're doing isn't useful. Correct. It doesn't mean that it's not a great habit to fall into, but let's be realistic about what toll it's actually taking and what it takes to recover from that.
Exactly. Yeah.
My next specific question, it might be one of my last ones of specific things that I see all the time, is when the day is finally done, I'm just relaxing on my couch at night, just watching YouTube on my phone, just letting my brain turn to mush, you know, a popular, and I'm not going to say the name because again, we don't want to throw it. It's a general concept, but I'll see this advertised regularly. And basically it is a powder, but it's not a protein. It's all like your vegetables, and you just pour this powder into the water, you mix it up, you drink your vegetables away, and you're a rock star. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's got wonderful, influential people all around the world supporting it. And it's, to me, it sounds like it just can't be that easy. Thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. This will probably come as a big surprise. I'm not a big fan of powdered greens or reds or fill in the blank of powdered vegetables. I think some of what people miss is that our health is also predicated on having a healthy weight. Now that's a whole nother conversation that I know we don't have the time for. I'm not saying that everybody needs to look like the cover of Muscle and Fitness magazine by any stretch of the imagination. But some of the cases in terms of preventative heart disease or preventative cancer, not all things are preventative, are because of excess weight, which comes in the form of excess calories, i.e. carbs and fat mostly. And I went through all of that because when we drink the veggie powder, we don't actually get the filling nature of eating the veggies or eating the fruits. Eating the veggies or eating the fruits have these very low caloric densities such that we actually fill up on them, and therefore our total calories come in line for the day. And so the argument is, well, I'm getting all of these quality nutrients from the powdered greens or reds or whatever it is. And it's like, yes, you are. And they're not harmful. But part of a healthy diet is also getting the quantity right. And
Actually getting them when you drink them? Like, does it absorb? Like, does it actually do? Is that one of the few things that actually gives to you what it says it gives to you?
Well, I will get to that. But yes, you are getting the nutrients that are in it, right? Like, let's say it has magnesium in it. You are getting some magnesium from it. But what you're not doing is you're not addressing the quantity in the diet, and you're still going to be just as full or not full to then go eat whatever else and eat too many calories. And so that's why I really encourage people to eat their food, because that tends to help get the total quantity in line, which is a part of health. It's not the only part of health, but it is part of the health.
Okay. Interesting.
When you ask though about like, am I actually getting things? Yes, there are some brands that are NSF certified such that the packet lists things. That's actually what's in the packet, and that is what your body gets. But some of the studies that we see don't find that supplements have the same effect. In fact, I was looking at some studies for magnesium, and the people who got their magnesium from dietary sources were better off than the people who got it from supplementation. The same thing is true with fiber. And so there is this believed to be synergistic effect that occurs in foods when we eat them, that we totally don't understand. Why does it work so well when we have it in the food form? I think that some of it is because of this quantity control, that when we eat whole foods, we tend to also control quantity. But there can also be something just in the terms of the forms, as the way that we absorb them, as the way that these nutrients interact, that isn't working out quite the same way when we do it in a supplement.
Yeah, I don't know why that would be, but that makes sense in my mind, that getting the real deal is always better than getting the down the chain processed carton package. That just makes natural sense to me. Why? I don't know, but I can follow the bouncing ball on that pretty darn easy.
Mm-hmm. Man, I got such a counterpoint on the reds powders. Okay. You mentioned you don't like them.
Let's hear it.
It's in jest, but I love it because some appeared in my kitchen cabinet a while back by way of my wife bringing it home, and it tastes delicious, so it gets me to drink more water.
Yes.
So I'll dump it in my water, as knowing that it's like, oh, I like drinking more water when I have this in there, and therefore I get a benefit out of it that way. I'm under no illusion that I get anything else out of it, but man, for that reason alone, I'm like, yep, that one's okay.
You're one of the weirdos. You're one of the weirdos, Boz, though. By your own admission, you're somebody who like go and then realized you haven't eaten and it's like 7 p.m. Oh, yeah. I've never lived a day where I've like intent. I know within 2 hours if I'm hungry or not, and I feed that. And that's why you're lean. You know, like if you're the unusual case of like, did I eat enough today? Most of us Americans,
bird bones, Pat.
Most of us Americans don't have that problem. Oh, I ate enough. I most certainly did.
Right. Yeah. I'm more like Pat. But I think that's also one of the reasons why electrolytes are so popular. People are like, oh, I feel so much better. And it's like, you might be more...
You're drinking more water.
Right. You actually are just now drinking more water. And sometimes they're flavored with a sweet taste and it's like, it tastes good. It's not that you act... In fact, most Americans have too much sodium in their diet by 1,000 milligrams per day. So it's not that you needed that. It's just that you like the taste better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my kid. I mean, and marketing is a wonderful thing, right? I mean, my kids who are into sports... Again, you know, we're everyone knows what we're talking about. I'm not looking to drop any names or throw any products under the bus. But, you know, very popular sports drink that's, you know, in every darn sport and has every professional athlete. I mean, they will not believe me that they don't need that to go play basketball. As far as they're concerned, it is mission critical to not only their performance, but they've got to slam one at the end to fully recover, replenish their electrolytes, and everyone else on the team is doing it. And every time I tell them you don't need it, they're just like, you're not sponsored by Nike. What do you know? We're not going to listen to you.
I just throw that back to the conversation we had earlier about, well, what happened pre-1930? You know?
Right.
There was no toil. There were no long duration efforts.
Right.
You know, before the invention of a supplement for something like electrolytes, as critical as electrolytes, people just, you know, 15 minutes of effort. That's it.
Can't perform without it. You know, believe it or not, we've been chatting for almost an hour. By this point in time, we're probably, and not that I have anywhere to be, but there's a certain point that we're probably, you know, got a hard time keeping the audience without doing a part two. I guess if we were going to start to close it down, you know, we could go on for quite some time. There's many things we haven't scratched the surface off. But if we were to start to wrap, is there one or two things that you would be sad that we didn't talk about because the mission critical? So let's hit it. Is there a topic that we've neglected?
We have done a pretty good job, I think.
We're professionals.
The audience will tell us that. But I do want to pick up a little bit on that 1930 thing. I also have to catch myself, because this is where my mind was too, that everything old was better and everything we did until 1930 was best. That is also incorrect.
Yeah.
But it is a good lens to think about, like, okay, somehow we got to that point without X, Y, and Z. And we could even go back a little bit earlier too, like 1850. Mm-hmm. Somehow we got to that point without all this other stuff. So what all this other stuff has to do has to be clearly above and beyond what we had then, right? Because it is possible that maybe we weren't living our optimal life up until 1930 or something like that. And there could be some advances. And I think protein powder is actually quite a good example of a food that helps people get protein without a ton of extra calories. And it's a great nutrient to have in a sustainable and flexible way. And so you could say that that's like a really great novel addition to the diet. So to just keep that in mind with the 1930 thing is I don't want us to also think that, you know, there's nothing that's better. But we also then have to be very critical of new stuff because it's like, gosh, we were so robust. robust. Does this actually add something to the outcome that we're looking for?
Yeah, that's a really great point because I, you know, I guess I can fall into that old man yells at cloud mentality as well, where where it's like, oh, yeah, of course, like none of it is worthwhile. But that's totally untrue to your point. And I would, maybe this is speculation, but even with some of the more dubious supplements out there for like a population application, I'm sure the case could be made that in certain contexts, it's like, yeah, that's an absolute lifesaver for an individual that truly does need that one thing and can't get it elsewhere. That's huge, you know, and there would have been no solution prior. So even in those kind of specific examples, I think that's a huge step forward.
So,
and there's also the one other thing I'll pick up on too, is I think we're talking about the sports drink, Pat. This is where it also gets really muddy when we then start thinking about the mental side of the athlete or the trainee. That if you feel better for the game or if you feel better for a training session, you might then have a better output, at which point helps your development, And so then it starts to be like, okay, well, then maybe it is helpful, but not by way of the fact it had electrolytes, but by way of the belief it brought. And I actually remember talking to Spiel in our CrossFit days, and he was like, at the time of his wrestling days, he really believed what he was eating was fueling him the best. And that's often the best diet for an athlete, by way of the belief. Yeah.
Look good, feel good, feel good, play good. Deion Sanders, you know what I mean? I mean, there you go. So that's all you need. If it gets you going between the ears and you show up and you're better than everybody, don't question what I'm doing.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
What was I just had something and my Deion Sanders got into my head and it went all the way. So is it safe to say, you know, if somebody's watching this and they're just, you know, they're like, oh my goodness, they're talking about me. And they were buying every month BCAAs, vitamin D, a multivitamin, fish oil, powdered veggies, greens and reds or whatnot. I mean, you could very easily spend a few hundred dollars on all those things that I just mentioned there. So is it safe to say you would recommend, or not recommend, maybe that's illegal to do, but for most people and in most circumstances, most of the time, they would be better served taking that money and buying more high quality, diverse meats, fruits and vegetables and just eating. And in eating that, you'll probably cover your bases pretty darn well.
Totally. A little bit of a diversity in the diet. You know, don't do the total watermelon and collagen diet. Like I always like to joke around, like don't pick some really wacky extreme thing. Have a few different protein sources, have a handful of different fruits and veggies. You're probably going to be pretty good. Maybe get your vitamin D checked at your doctor, see what they say. Done.
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. So let's say, when you're not eating in the ideal ways of the gods, what is it that you allow yourself as some treats that just, you know, you deviate from? It puts a smile on your face.
Yeah, well, I think I had some chips in the lounge at the Rogue Invitational this weekend. They were delicious.
Just a regular? We're talking sour cream and onion? What do you mean?
Yeah, regular potato chips. They were great. I had them with a chicken sandwich and I had some in the lounge. I have deviations regularly because I always have fruits and veggies and protein in my diet. And so every day there's room for something. So that's where people should be. It shouldn't be this, like, I'm saving up till Saturday night only.
Mm-hmm. And you, Mr. Bosin, what puts a smile on your face as a sweet treat or a crunchy treat or a salty treat or whatever it is?
Oh, you know, Pat, I got a couple of go-tos in the old cupboard there. But I get a lot of flack for this, but I love really gross licorice. It's the best.
Black licorice.
You don't even need to call it black because, you know, the other kinds of licorice are not really licorice. It's like saying that fish kind of fish. You know? But I love nasty licorice. But honestly, Pat, I think the one thing that I enjoy more than anything else is just like a good stiff drink once in a while. And that's kind of taboo to talk about a lot of times. But like, yeah, I love having a cocktail once in a while. And I don't have any problem with that.
Some of the listeners might connect. What would be one or two of your favorites? If somebody meets you in a bar, like, you know what? Drinks on me tonight, Boz.
Oh, man, a Manhattan or a Negroni will always put a smile on my face.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. There you go. Nice. I don't deviate. So, I don't know what you guys are talking about.
You're an ice cream guy. You make your own ice cream, for gosh sake.
I do like ice cream. I like it all. I like ice cream. And I'm a big fan of breads, like a pumpkin bread, a banana bread, and things like that. Oh, man, I could have a loaf of pumpkin bread as a serving and look down and be like, where did that go? Did I eat all of that? Like, just like that. So good. Thank you so much, EC, for sharing your knowledge. I forget to do this all the time. I'm supposed to say this at the top of the show. Everybody, go to verynotrandom.com. Check out some of the cycles that Boz and I check out, create and promote. You'll love them. Get your first pull up. Become a beast, and you'll have a blast. Okay, now that's out of the way. EC, if people want to learn more about you, find you on the interwebs. You know, you mentioned that you do coaching, the whole nine yards. Promote away. How can people find you?
Yeah. OptimizeMeNutrition.com, Optimize Me Nutrition on Facebook and Instagram, and the Consistency Project podcast.
Very cool. I
love it.
I have a couple of your podcasts like saved for common questions that I get. And I will just, that will be my answer. Like when I do other shows and are discussing something from my community, they'll ask, well, what about fill in the blank fitness trackers? I'll be like, I'm not even going to get into that. EC did two full podcasts on that. So you go and listen to this 1 hour of content. There's your answer. So I've got some of those just saved.
Oh, thank you.
That I'll do that. So I'm going to clip out the segments on the electrolyte drinks here and just, you know, send them to my boys. And that'll be that.
Yeah. Well, and to piggyback on that, I just want to say thanks for coming on. And, you know, I will speak for Pat. I won't do it often, but I'll in this context, I will. And I just think you're one of the few people that are in the nutrition space that are doing it with such integrity. Mm. And, you know, you're willing to build this body of work the long and hard way, as opposed to what most people are going to do, which is, you know, try to cash in on a flash fad or present something in a way that becomes instantly appealing. And mm-hmm. I just have so much respect for that. So keep fighting the good fight. It's really awesome and inspiring to see it. Yeah.
Thank you. That means a lot.
100%. So check out EC, find all that information, dive in. And I know for a fact, you know, nutrition is one of those things that people have strong opinions on. So I'm sure listening to this show, you've got strong opinions on one side of the fence or the other, experiences on one side or the other, agree or disagree. We want to hear it all. Find this episode on the BTWB YouTube channel and then post your thoughts, discussions, topics, the whole nine yards in those comments. We check them out. It's a great way to share knowledge. It's also a great way to provide us with information, insight, and ideas for future shows. So let us know if, you know, there's something in the future that we should discuss, and we pay attention to those things. So, for EC Sienkowski and Adrian Bosman, I'm Pat Sherwood, and we will see you next time.